Hello. Welcome back.
Welcome to Happy Little Magic.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sorry the world's on fire. Just do your best and please take care of yourselves. Because fuck this shit.
Fuck it in the asshole.
Yeah. And also, okay, so partly, like, we took time off for the overturning of Roe v. Wade because as people with uteruses, and us specifically being women.
Yes. We were very upset.
Very upset.
And still upset.
Yeah, we know that our fellow women and our fellow uterus-bearing brothers and siblings are also having a hard time with this, so we hope that you're doing your best to take care of yourself. Besides, of course, that, personally, my husband and I had to go to the hospital because he got to get surgery on his throat because he had, like, a really weird pus pocket that was closing off his airway. So that was hooray.
Yay for me who doesn't have tonsils.
Yeah, no, he was supposed to get them taken out, like, 15 years ago. They didn't do it for whatever reason, so...
Now he's gonna suffer.
And he has a gross hole in his throat, and it's so nasty. I feel so bad. It's healing right now, and he's hurting a little bit, but...
It's gross.
Thankfully, now he's healing, and even though Roe v. Wade is still overturned, Joe Biden just signed an executive order to protect abortion rights across the states, so hopefully... Him and every other politician who's been talking about how they were going to make sure that this didn't happen, get off their asses and actually fucking do it.
Fucking move.
But now that we're done talking about that for now.
It'll come up later.
It will come up later because we will bitch about it consistently until something is done because that's pretty much all we can do. But now we're going to talk about fun things like the hyperfixation I carried throughout most of my life, Greek and Roman mythology.
Yes, I actually took a mythology class in high school because I was so in love and I had the best teacher ever.
I love learning about Greek and Roman myths and hyperfixated on that. And then Percy Jackson is probably one of the best young adult series I've ever fucking read. It's so good.
Oh my God, yes.
I can't wait for the show to come out.
Yes.
I really love that Riordan is like, every time somebody says something stupid and fucking racist, he's just like, shut the hell up.
Stop talking.
These are my kids and you can go fuck yourself. I'm like,
I literally
thank you.
Created this world. You can go.
I realize the bar in hell is in hell, right? Because we shouldn't be allowing racist fucking shit, but I'm glad that he's not just being quiet about it.
Yeah,
you know, it's gonna be cool to see, but anyways, yeah, we're gonna talk about how Greek and Romans of course had their own magic and, you know, some of the myths because there's a lot of cool stuff about it. We're still using the history of magic.
Yes, we are book. Still using the history of magic, witchcraft, and the occult. It was put out by the British Museum and it is so fun to read.
It is
and
so good.
Like I said, I took a mythology class in high school. I had to learn the names of all the muses, and I'm not very good with mnemonic devices and remembering things because I just don't remember at all. It's fine.
And the book I will be drawing most of my sources from is The Friendly Guide to Mythology by Nancy Hathaway. And then, of course, my own collection of knowledge over the years from having read multiple sources of the same myths because once again I hyperfixated on them real bad.
I've always loved mythology, especially Greek and Roman, but it's a very different take on it because when you're in school you learn the stories and you don't really hear about what life was actually like in a daily sense because so much of it was rampant with magic, and that is more of a religious aspect for American schools. So
for a second I had a mini heart attack because I didn't see the counter. And I was just like, shit, are we even recording right now? Fuck. No,
no.
No, we are. Anyways, take it away, my darling.
formal religion in ancient Greece was rather public. They had magicians, soothsayers, even prostitutes would cast love spells. So, you know.
Very entrenched in their society.
I don't know if it was for them to love the prostitute enough to fuck her, or if it was just for the prostitute to help them fuck somebody else.
You know, if anything, I think it was to encourage tips so that they could so that they could make an honest living, as they should.
Do you think they had tips 6,000 years ago?
Well, I mean, they had to pay him still, probably.
They had to pay him something.
So they paid more than asking price.
Like,
they probably weren't referred to as tips back then.
Yeah, they probably just, like, keep the change kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you for making it so that I can now fuck this lady.
Yeah.
Keep the change.
Keep the change.
That's a 20.
Make sure that this man who is fucking me instead of his wife gives me significant money. Thank you.
But you had philosophers, Greek philosophers, that claimed to reject magic. Philosophers, yes.
Yep.
They claimed to reject magic. They were the authors of the Hippocratic medical text. They scorned the notion that spells could cause an eclipse or cure a fever. But the same magicians were prescribing sleeping in sacred precincts of gods, Alcestis, to heal ailments. So they were not so sure themselves.
There's ghosts in your blood. Do cocaine about it. But ancient Greek addiction.
Yeah, Greeks.
Sleep in a holy place.
They would turn to remedies like
and munch
talking
root.
To Eros, the god of love, or more darkly, the goddess Hecate of witchcraft. So Greeks were absolutely entrenched, living in the moment with this. Certain stones were, like we have now, crystals, like bloodstone, thought to protect unborn babies, and light green jasper was used to help cure stomach infections. So they would put them in amulets, wood, bone, stone, anything that they could wear. Sailors would have protected pendants of a trident or like a dolphin, or some of them would even have the evil eye, which would be to ward off the gaze of any evil. Like, hey, look at this versus me. They had spell books by the thousands. Wands were very, very common. The enchantress Circe would polish stones, mirrors, water basins, cymbals, harps, and rhombos, which is a spinner used to amplify magical power. Magicians employed pharmaca, the origin of the word pharmacy, but they used it as potions. If you've ever read the Odyssey, you know, like most anybody that has a semi-decent American education, you've read the Iliad and the Odyssey at some point. Or at least had it read to you while you were in class and trying to, like, not fall asleep because they made it so dry and boring.
Classical texts are hard to read.
They are. They're very difficult, but I loved them. I was the freak of nature in that case. Odysseus takes a potion made from moly, a magical herb, to stop Circe from turning him into a pig. Pharmaca were supplemented by philtra, or love potions and poisons. The latter appeared in the myths of Hercules. Deianira, his wife, accidentally killed her husband when she smeared his cloak with philtra, which is the blood of the centaur Nessus.
Cool.
So there's lots of fun little tidbits in here. It really kicked up around the 6th century. because all of the magic from the Persians was being brought over to the Greeks, and it was started off just as oral tradition. There wasn't anything physical about it. It was just, hey, this is what we've heard. And
an eternal game of telephone.
Yes, it is the ancient game of telephone. So they also ended up getting some of the papyri that were in Egypt, and they would trade with Egypt a lot of their spells. So you find some Greek spells in ancient Egypt, and that's kind of a cool thing to realize that people were still traveling even then. Much of the theory of Greek magic, in particular, was the concept of binding or taking control of physical or intellectual attributes of their particular victim that they're looking at, and binding them to the will of the caster. So basically, I bind you to do this or not be able to do this. There was a group of witches known as the Thracian witches, and they would actually bind celestial objects like the moon. They felt that it could be bound in a ritual that they called drawing down the moon, which is still a thing in modern witchcraft. It's just not common. And they would collect moon foam to act as an amplifier in magical potions. There were public and private curses. Public ones were tombs that warned passersby to leave the graves alone, or civic, so associated with a vow made by the people of Thera to colonize Cyrene in North Africa. So there was a group that basically wanted to set up shop right near the Egyptians, and they melted wax figurines so that if they failed to fulfill their oath, they would be melted as well. Super encouraging.
Woo!
More private curses were things like poppets or figures, or could also just be written down, and it often started with the words "I bind," and then you state what you want. You can list all the parts of their body. Some of them would just bind limbs. Like if you're an athlete, they would bind your limbs so that you couldn't race or you couldn't participate in the competition.
Throw that discus.
Right.
No discus throwing for you.
No discus, bitch. So they also had thergy, which was an attempt to bind the gods. Usually it was done through a practitioner rather than doing it by yourself, because you don't have the protections that the practitioner does.
Yeah, because believe it or not, if you're going to be binding people and doing any kind of baneful magic towards somebody, you either got to be prepared for them to come for your ass, or you got to be prepared for their spirit guides or their patrons if they have any, or anything like that.
Yep. And practitioners of Thergy would always make sure that they had a god or a goddess on their side to help protect them. So it was also very, very difficult. Practitioners of Thergy would project themselves into a divine realm through dreams, or achieve visions through lacanomancy, which is dropping oil on water in a basin. And basically the ripples would help them understand what the gods were attempting to say. Labanomancy was also making contact with the gods, but it was interpreting the flames of lamps. So there's that.
So like highly specialized pyromancy.
Yes. Very specialized. Basically, the divination side of pyromancy, I would assume.
Yes.
The other thing is that they would also call on the dead sometimes.
Oh boy.
So the Greeks and Romans were wild, guys. Not even gonna joke. Curses that represented the darker side of Greek magic were only surpassed by necromancy. So they never went quite to necromancy in Greece. Rome, they definitely did. We're getting to that.
To wrap in.
No, at this point, this was just the art of speaking to the dead. They would write out their curses on really thin lead sheets and then drop them in a well. And it was intended so that when they dropped it in a well, it was supposed to reach Hades in the underworld, where you could assume that the Furies or the Praxitici, which were demonic spirits of vengeance, were able to receive those tablets and carry out your will. One that was found, they actually have a picture of it. It was found from the 5th century, and it calls for the rivals of the person writing it in a legal case to be rendered incapable of pleading their side in court. Literally the same things that we do now. Like, beg and plead that this isn't going to work out for whatever reason. Pray that your ex's new lover is terrible. Pray, like, all kinds of things. It was the same as it is now. It's just magic was so much more imbued into their daily lives.
Yeah, they thought of it as magic, whereas now you might not think, God, I hope that person steps on a Lego is magic, but that's basically, that's baneful magic, homie. That is you wishing somebody to suffer pain, which is often what baneful magic is, if it's not, you know, getting some kind of revenge or something like that.
I'm not above it. I do not advise it for new people.
I think that, like anything else, you should know exactly what you're getting into before you mess with it. And just be prepared to, whether you believe in the threefold law or not, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And that's just a scientific fact. So
yes,
it may not come back at you the way you think it's going to, but it might come back at you. So always be prepared to deal with your own consequences.
Always, 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 always. In an example, I have somebody that I exited from my life a while ago, and it has come to my attention that a mutual friend of ours that also exited this individual from our lives has been having issues lately, and we've had to perform some return to senders. So if you get into a position where you feel like that's an issue, there are ways around it, but this is just the history of it.
keep in mind, if somebody has done something to you and you are coming back at them with what they did to you, that is their consequences.
Oh, I'm aware.
Your consequences were received when they decided to point that at you to start with.
I didn't need consequences.
Exactly.
I didn't do anything wrong.
Exactly. Like, consequences is not necessarily the right word, but you already suffered from that.
Yep.
Transactional sort of energy. So giving it back to them is not, your karma's not going to come for you when, what's the word I'm trying to, like, if
you're returning the letter that was sent, i.e. the curse, you're not doing anything wrong by
you're not doing anything to prompt any kind of reaction. Like, if you're starting it and somebody finishes it, that's another thing. But if somebody else started it and you're finishing it, then chances are you're good all the way down.
If you want to start some shit, then you've got to be prepared for your shit consequences.
Yes.
Just be aware of this.
Whether or not they're deserved, sometimes life is just that way.
Yes.
You might not deserve the consequences that come back at you for getting some kind of revenge or payback. Like, obviously. You know, some people just suck and they manage to hurt you back anyway, even though they shouldn't have. Yes. But yeah.
Because suck. But anyway.
Because suck. And life is suck sometimes.
Ancient Greeks were very, very big fans of oracles. That's fun.
Information, y'all.
Yes, they would call them readers of dreams. A lot of diviners specialized in things like orthonomancy, which is watching the birds and the direction they're flying and interpreting it. That sounds like a very fancy way of just making a lot of money by bird watching, but it's a thing that people do. Birds and animals in general have a lot of different erratic behaviors based upon your reactions and what's going on in the world if there's something wrong.
Animals definitely have a closer connection to kind of like the latent psychicism that exists. I'm sure that's not a word, but the latent psychic abilities that I think everybody has, whether or not you foster that, whether or not you bury that, whether or not you just have a natural affinity for it, which does happen,
yes,
is entirely up for debate. But I think everybody has a little bit of it in them.
Somewhere.
And animals just have it just straight up because they don't have to worry about material concerns and stuff like that.
They're part of the Matrix, guys.
Part of the Matrix. We're all in a simulation. It wouldn't surprise me.
No, we'll get into the CIA declassified documents later.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Anyway, so we have orthonomancy, or everyone's super favorite. All the animal activists would love this. They had hepatomancy, which was sacrificing animals and reading their livers. Or you had extipacy, which was removing the entrails of sacrificial pigs to divine the future. Literally just reading their entrails. That's friendly.
The Egyptians did that too.
Yes, they did.
I'm pretty sure every ancient civilization did. Maybe just with different animals.
But again, it was one of those things where they're not going to give you super specifics. You have to put aside your arrogance and your thoughts about what's going on. Lots of people like to go to priestesses at different temples and get their fortunes read. There was one priestess that was super renowned throughout the land, and it was the priestess of Apollo in a town of Delphi. She would inhale fumes that were from an underground cavern, I'm assuming some sort of sulfur or something of the like, and give her oracle, like her oracular reply. And one point in 546 BC, Croesus, which was the king of Lydia, asked if he could engage in battle with Persians that were invading. Her response was that if he did so, he would destroy a great empire. He got all bad about it. He was like, hell yeah, I can do this. He attacked, and then he was so badly defeated that his empire was destroyed. So again, you may think you know what you're hearing, but if you're being a pompous ass, you're probably not.
if there's anything divination does, it is knock you right back down to earth with a quickness.
Very, very quickly and very, very efficiently. Yeah. Anything to add on Greeks?
Yes, I have, after this short intermission. Yay, brief intermission over.
Yay!
Our episodes are actually getting long enough now that we have to split them into segments.
This is fun.
This is good.
All right.
Okay, yeah. So piggybacking off of Rissy Mae's lovely research, I dug into the mythology side of it. And it's really cool because it seems like a lot of the religious mythos throughout pretty much every culture that I've looked at so far has like common denominators, like the Greek creation myth, depending on who you ask, has a serpent in it.
Mm.
Okay.
The wise.
Now, the goddess worshipping Pelasgians. I really need to look up how to pronounce these before I whatever, but who cares? Anyways, sorry.
It's okay.
The Pelasgians, who supposedly entered Greece around 350 BCE, proclaimed, parentheses, according to myth reconstructed by Robert Graves, end parentheses, that creation began when Eurynome, the goddess of all things, arose from chaos, separated from the sky, and started to dance. As she whirled around, she generated the wind, which turned into a giant serpent, and they made love. And then she turned into a dove and laid the cosmic egg. So mythology is weird.
I'm kind of concerned with how you fuck a serpent that you just created out of air.
Would that not be... Well, it became its own fully fledged being, so maybe not necessarily, but like, wouldn't that just be like really fancy masturbation at that point?
Does she use the tail? Does she use the head?
I really don't know, but it doesn't matter because afterward she turned into a dove and laid an egg.
There's a reason why this is an 18 plus show.
Okay. It does not make any sense because she turned into a dove and turned into an egg. Then the serpent wound its body around the egg 7 times and remained in that position until the egg was hatched. So that is one of the Egyptian creation myths. The other one is from the 8th century poet Hesiod.
Hi,
Hesiod. He writes that in the beginning there was chaos. There wasn't deities. It was just the element chaos. A yawning void. From chaos came Gaia, Nyx, Erebos, the underworld Tartarus, and seductive Eros, who was not necessarily a god, but an energy, like the, like the something, attraction, like the energy of attraction.
The tingling that you get when you get excited.
He's not much of a character in Hesiod's, talk of it. He reports that Gaia gave birth by herself without pleasant love to the hills, the sea, and the starry sky. A deity named Uranus, with whom she mated, and then they had a bunch of kids. From Uranus and Gaia came the Titans, as we know them. Cronos, Rhea, Thea, Epetos, Oceanus, Themis, which is justice, and Mnemosyne, which is memory.
Mnemosyne. That was one of the few that I remember.
Mnemosyne. Well, I'm glad you remember that, and that's how bizarre. And then from the Titans came Atlas, Prometheus, Epimetheus, Helios, the sun, Selene, the moon, Eos, Dawn, and Leto, the daughter of Chios and Phoebe, and the mother of Artemis and Apollo. So I'm sure most people know the myth about how Cronos heard that Zeus and his other children were going to usurp him of his power, and he didn't want that, so he ate all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Then Zeus cut his way out.
Mm-hmm.
They killed him.
Mm-hmm.
By cutting him up into pieces and throwing him into Tartarus.
Well, you know, for funsies.
Well, the same kind of thing happened with Uranus, Cronos's father.
Hmm.
Because Uranus imprisoned them within the earth where they languished for years before they broke out and usurped him and Gaia.
Yeah.
So it seems like the Greek mythos has a cyclical issue with fathers.
If you're Greek.
The Greeks got daddy
issues.
Do you have daddy issues?
I want to know. Is it like a Greek-wide thing? for everybody that's Greek, somebody from Greece, listen to this podcast. Let me know.
Let me know. We wish to know. Yeah. Which was, that is part of their creation myth. So it's funny that there's also a snake in there, at least in one of them. They also have their own version of the flood.
Yes.
Including a Noah and Noah's wife like figure who made an ark. So interesting. Several theories about the flood are that Zeus flooded the earth because he was angry that Prometheus had stolen fire and given it to mankind. Or there was this king named Lycaon who gave Jupiter a hard time. Either it was his children gave him a soup that had his own kids' guts in it, or he was being a cocky guy. And Zeus wasn't cool with that, so he turned his sons into wolves, except for the one who was killed.
Well, you know.
And was so full of despair that he flooded the earth.
Yay.
But the common denominator in both of these is that Zeus let loose the south wind, who flew into the heavens and crushed the clouds and caused sheets of rain, pummeled the earth. The quote... the water rose so high that wolves, lions, tigers, and wild boars swam in the waves. Dolphins knocked against the branches of oak trees. And the birds, unable to find a place to alight, fell into the sea, exhausted.
Oh.
Everyone might have died if it were not for Prometheus, who had warned his son, Deucalion, who is the Noah in this version of the myth. He was called the best man who ever lived. He constructed an ark for himself and his wife, Pyrrha. And so they survived the storm.
Oh, look at that.
Which is really cool. It talks about the creation of humans as they did it in several stages. The first group of humans were called... gold. They were made of gold, according to Hesiod, but according to Ovid, the time that they lived in was called the Golden Age, and they weren't literally made of golds. But both agreed that their lives were idyllic. They lived with happy hearts untouched by work or sorrow, according to Hesiod.
Sound a little bit like Adam and Eve, guys?
Just a little bit, only there was more than two.
What?
Eventually, Zeus overthrew Cronos, who was banished to the dark recesses of Tartarus, as before mentioned, and the people of the Golden Age died out.
Dead, Jim.
Says they still exist as spirits who give us wealth and keep us safe from harm.
Alrighty then.
And then from there, they made silver humans.
Yay!
Who were worse than the gold ones, because that's how that works.
They do, like, bronze and lead, too?
They did bronze and iron.
Ooh,
and
fancy.
And iron... is us.
Fucking hate it here.
Finally, Zeus made a fifth race. The miserable race of iron. Who work, grieve, grow weary, and die.
Fuck you, Zeus.
Don't. He might take you literally. Let's not.
Okay. I don't want to fuck you. I'm saying it in the insult way. Not the please come here way.
It's funny. After all of this with humans... things reached such a sorry pass that Justice, the last goddess to remain on Earth, because the gods were slowly abandoning Earth after this, was the last goddess to remain on Earth, finally abandoned it and joined the other immortals, leaving behind only demigods, spirits, fauns, satyrs, nymphs, and human beings. And Hesiod was like, I wish I were not of this race. Hathaway says, like ourselves, he had no such luck.
Hathaway. You didn't have to do me dirty like that.
Yeah.
You didn't have to say that.
Rip in peace. But anyways, a flood and a serpent in two creation myths. Funny.
Or extra fun.
Yeah. Right.
Alrighty. Are we ready for the next ones? Or you got more?
Do I got a little more? Well.
Because we have Romans too.
Yes, we got the Romans. Take it away.
Okay. So, Greeks kind of gave the Romans some ideas.
Yes, hence why all of their gods are virtually the same, except for their names. Zeus is Jupiter, Hera is Juno, Hermes is Mercury, etc.
Isn't Uranus Poseidon?
Yes.
Even though the seas, it was blue.
I think so, yes. Yeah. Uranus was Poseidon, Aphrodite is Venus.
Okay.
When Pluto is Hades.
Fun fact, when I was in high school, none of us could say Uranus without giggling.
Yes. Teenagers. A universal experience, truly.
So, to combat that, the teacher that I had, she's like, we're not calling it Uranus, we're calling it Uranos.
Uranos is how the Romans probably pronounced that.
Yes, and she was brilliant for it, and I loved her so much. Miss Renner, wherever you are, God bless you.
Hope you're doing well.
So it was kind of a hard time for the Romans because they had their own magical ideals. A lot of it was inherited from the Greeks, and then all of a sudden they switched to Christianity and it started becoming outlawed. So there was a good long time where they were able to make public sacrifices to ensure the city's safety. They did a lot as far as politically using magic in their daily lives to help their empire succeed. They had priests called Haruspex. They would make predictions in the form of coloration of animals' livers. So again, back
always
to
with
that.
The livers.
Yeah, back to the hepatomancy all over again. They would use those entrails and then make sacrifices going forward to protect everybody. They also used augury, which we all now know as meteorology. they would literally just read weather patterns. But they also used bird flight patterns and entrails of sacrificial animals. So they didn't individualize each piece. They would group them together. Anything to do with weather, animal readings, it was all, you're getting more of a catch-all when it comes to your sorcerers and magicians rather than individual specialties. Under the Roman Republic from 509 BCE, both became official practices of the Roman state. After the conquest of Greece in the 2nd century, the Greek belief in binding magic, including curse tablets to ensure victory in competitions or over romantic rivals, began to permeate Roman culture. So amulets were more common. They actually used phallus-shaped charms worn by all Roman boys as a protection against the evil eye. So nobody needs evil eyes, just use dicks.
Dicks are scary enough for anything, apparently.
Just use dicks. Even emperors would use magic. Marcus Aurelius attacked the Germanic Cadi on the Danube. His troops were saved from dying of thirst by a downpour supposedly invoked by Arnufus, which was an Egyptian magician. Emperors also consulted what were called the Sibylline books. Now, Sibyl was a prophetess who lived in a cave just outside of Naples, and the books that she wrote as predictions were kept in the Capitoline Jupiter. They were only consulted in times of severe crisis. And, for example, after the Carthaginians defeated the Roman army at Cannae in 216 BC, when the priests interpreted the books and advised that it was necessary to sacrifice 2 Gauls and 2 Greeks, 4 men ended up buried alive beneath the Forum Boarium, which was the city's ancient marketplace. So basically, yes, she not only made predictions, but she also told them how they could win. And they followed it pretty religiously. There was a time where it started merging with philosophy, and we had mystery cults popping up all over ancient Rome. So an interest in esoteric belief systems grew among Romans, including Pythagoreanism, the worship of Isis, Hermeticism, a branch of philosophical school called Neoplatonism that ascribed to the creation of the world to a female power named Hecate. Yes, I'm sure you were all excited for that one. On the streets of Rome, which had about 1 million inhabitants under the early empire, different schools of magic were also thriving. So there were soothsayers, precantresses, which were female sorceresses who sold love potions and simple healing rituals, and astrologers. Yes, astrology was very much a Roman thing. They studied the divide between popular and aristocratic magic. So they were that dividing line. If you've ever heard of Claudius Ptolemy, the guy that, you know, decided that the earth was the center of the universe, he pointed out that just as tides were affected by the moon, the motion of the planets would intuitively influence behavior of men. That part I can agree with. Not so much on the world being in the center of the universe. Strange how that works.
It makes sense. We're mostly water. If the moon influences the tides, then why can't the planets influence us on some level?
The way that I've always looked at astrology is that at some point, I mean, everything emits some sort of energy.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's just a scientific thing. That's not even necessarily
so
metaphysical belief.
Why would you not necessarily be influenced by the energy that you are exposed to directly out of the womb?
Like a magnet is affected by another magnet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The planets being in the positions that they're in, the moon being the position that it's in, it would all affect how you perceive the world just by being born and exposed to it in that moment. Mm. That's what I was saying.
Fascinating.
All right. Anyway, surviving Roman horoscopes actually include a few predictions, but astrologers provided them. They were based on a belief that the soul, in descending to earth before its birth, acquired certain traits from planetary spheres, such as cunning from Saturn, martial spirit from Mars, oratory from Mercury, and ruling power from Jupiter. Predictions also caused the astrologer's downfall. In 16 CE, a horoscope foretelling that Drusus Libo, a well-connected but dissolute aristocrat, would one day become emperor, which led to his arrest and then suicide before trial. So basically they were like, hey, you could be emperor, and they're like, no, kill him.
Nope, die.
You should do the
get
die
out of here. Do the die
now. Romans had a really big fear of harmful magic, and it ran really deep. They made lots of laws against veneficum, which is malign magic. They made all kinds of laws about it. And lots of even high-profile people would get caught and kicked out. They did get into necromancy. When Germanicus, the adoptive son of Tiberius, died suddenly in 19 CE, there was a rumor linked to his death with magic. So they found burned bodies in his room with tablets and spells. And burned bodies is essentially them trying to remove the life force from one to put into another, but they're also used as a way to communicate with the dead. If I can tell you what I want the dead to know and then burn your body, you can go send the message, which is horrifying. The Emperor Nero was also said to have conjured the mother or his mother's ghost to beg her forgiveness after he murdered her.
Whack.
So there's that. Witches had really terrifying amounts of power, and it was starting to become vilified the more Christianity rose to power. There's big and scary things, and we don't know what to do with them. The mystery cults
became they're different.
Very popular.
Kill them.
Oh, yeah. Mystery cults became very, very popular. One of which was the Eleusinian Mysteries, which honored Demeter, the goddess of harvest, fertility, and cycles of life and death. They were mostly in a town just outside of Athens, and their main ceremony was an annual 8-day festival celebrating that... I can't talk. Hold on.
Words. That's okay. Come back, words.
8-day festival during which initiates engaged in a stimulated descent into Hades through a dark wood, which they were rescued by priests with torches. So set you out in the woods for 8 days and then they'll come save you because you went to go see Hades. Isn't that fun? There were Italian cults to Dionysus, and they like to just get down to fucking, because Dionysus likes to do that.
Dionysus.
They also had a cult for Magna Mater, which is a great mother, derived from the worship of the Asiatic moon goddess Cybele and her consort Attis. Symbols were used to rouse themselves to euphoric frenzies, and the most enthusiastic male worshippers would actually castrate themselves.
Jesus.
So, again, fun times, guys. Isis was also pretty heavily worshipped, but they started to get into the cult of Mithras, which was emerging in the 1st century. It derived indirectly from Persians, and the main ritual was a bull sacrifice in which the blood of the dying animal symbolized purity and rebirth. All male members were graded into 7 ranks, from Korax, which was raven, all the way up to Pater, father. And initiates worshipped Mithras, underground rectangular temples, simulating caves. Mithraism flourished through the Roman Empire, but along with all the other mystery cults, it was suppressed when the empire became Christian in the 4th century, because why not force other people into my shit?
Yeah, let's make people do things against their will. That sounds like a wonderful idea.
And that is the Roman history of occultism.
And now, here's the Roman myth.
Yay!
I love that Hathaway put this line in here. The first line under the myth, Romulus and Remus, as I'm sure we are all familiar with, because that is how the capital of Rome and the empire of the Romans mythologically came to be.
Yeah.
Is life isn't fair and neither is mythology.
Way to go, Hathaway.
When Rhea Silvia was a Vestal virgin, the Roman god Mars, otherwise known as Ares, in the Greek mythos, raped her, and she became pregnant with twins. That wasn't considered a crime at the time, because why not? Because what the fuck? Because
she's not human.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, the next part is becoming pregnant when you're supposed to be a virgin is a crime. So she was either imprisoned or drowned. Which is terrible. Her children were also supposed to be
ground. They were taken away from her. But instead, like Moses, this is a quote from the book, instead, like Moses, they were set adrift in a basket.
Aww.
It came ashore on the banks of the Tiber under a fig tree where a she-wolf suckled them and raised them, according to the myth. They were, as often happens in myths about heroes, the boys were raised by foster parents after that. A herdsman named Faustulus and his wife, Accia, A-C-C-A, Laurentia. Mm-hmm. When they were grown, they wanted to find a city, but they fought over the location. So Romulus killed Remus.
Of course.
After this city, Rome, was built, many men came to live there, including exiles and fugitives. Romulus offered them asylum. Women were not in this city at the time. Hmm. It was largely men. To fill the vacancy, Romulus invited the neighboring people, the Sabines, to a religious festival. Unfortunately, as Greek and Roman myths go, they did what you assumed they would do when the women came.
They raped them.
They raped them. And war broke out. The women who somehow, I like that Hathaway put this, who somehow aligned themselves with the Romans after they were doing that to them, threw themselves between the opposing factions and brought the fighting to a halt.
We don't know why they aligned with people that raped them, but go on.
Product of the time, unfortunately.
Stockholm syndrome gone bad.
Yeah, pretty much. Ultimately, Romulus went the way of tyrants, yes. According to Plutarch, he forsook his popular behavior for kingly arrogance, odious to the people. Mm. He dressed in scarlet and purple, gave audiences while reclining on a couch, Caesar behavior, mm-hmm. and surrounded himself with a gang of thugs who carried leather thongs and were happy to bind up anyone he so designated.
Fun.
He died under mysterious circumstances, a.k.a. assassination. Somebody killed
him. Your boy was moited.
He was moited. After his death in 715 BCE, a friend of his, one Julius Proculus, announced that he had seen Romulus on the road, looking taller and comelier than ever, dressed in shining and flaming armor. That's pretty gay, Julius.
It does.
We're not judging you, but they would at the time. Romulus, son of Mars, told Proculus that the gods took him to heaven, where he became a god known as Quirinus. Farewell, he said, and tell the Romans that, by the exercise of temperance and fortitude, they shall attain the height of human power. And the Roman Empire did indeed conquer much of the known world at the time for a good long while. Until their ultimate demise.
Is that where you think the term flaming came from?
Maybe so. Oh my gosh. Yep, no.
So that is Greek and Roman history. We will be working on some more history for you guys. If you have suggestions, questions, we can always look into other things.
Drop them off at the Facebook group, Happy Little Magics. Twitter, Happy Lil L-I-L Magics.
Or you can always email us at happylittlemagics@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Please do.
And also, keep an eye on our Facebook page because we're going to be going to another Misfits Market.
On the 16th.
On the 16th. So come say hi. And thank you to everyone who came to say hi before. That was really fun.
Yes, thank you.
And it was so cool to meet people.
We'll see you next time.
Okay. Yeah, we will see you next time. Okay, thank you for listening. Bye.